Tom Riddle. The formation of Dumbledore's army, which includes students from all of the houses except Slytherin, shows that house or national divisions mattered little when everyone is affected equally by an external threat, and that unifying in the face of that threat can be an effective response to it. Patriotism and global conflict. Let's consider one more possible problem with patriotism before we look for a way to make sense of it. Many people think being patriotic simply requires you to love your country. That's good as far as it goes, but what does someone who loves her country do? Here's one possible answer. If you love your country, doesn't that mean wanting your countrymen to live well and have all the trappings of a good life? Yet living the typical American middle-class life, with a large house in the suburbs, cars, vacations, large TVs, high-calorie meals and so forth, costs a lot of money and consumes a significant amount of the world's scarce resources. It looks like the only way to maintain this good life for us and our countrymen is either to exploit the people of other countries. They have to work cheaply so that we can afford the goods they make, and they have to go without cars and large houses so that the price of oil and other essential resources stays low for us. Or for us to use more than our fair share of the world's resources, thus denying them to others. Either way, it might be thought that our well-being depends on other people living much less well than we do. Think again of the house elves at Hogwarts. How much does the well-being of the students depend on the horrid working conditions of the enslaved elves? If this line of thought is right, and if we agree that everyone counts equally, it seems to follow that we will have to significantly curtail our lifestyles and dial down our high standards of living so that others can climb out of back-breaking poverty. So then, if loving your country means endorsing the high standard of living that your countrymen enjoy, this will mean taking steps to exploit the citizens of other countries, and that is tantamount, isn't it, to thinking that the well-being of your fellow Americans is more important than the well-being of other people. And that sounds pretty close to the idea that the people of your country are morally superior to the people of other countries. Of course, there are a number of ifs in this line of reasoning, and quite a few possible objections. You might think that raising the standard of living in other countries actually serves to benefit our economy. The more money that people in other countries have, the more stuff of ours they can buy, and the less foreign aid from us they will need. But even so, the issue of scarce resources helps us to see the possible conflict between patriotism and the moral point of view that gives equal moral standing to all persons. Accordingly, if we wish to maintain the view that patriotism is a virtue, we have to figure out a way to understand patriotism so that it doesn't conflict with the powerfully attractive view that all people, of whatever nationality, are of equal moral worth. Let's now look at how we can do that. Patriotism restored. We've seen some major dangers of patriotism. It promotes an unjustified sense that we are morally better than them. It may lead to economic imperialism, and it may prevent united action in situations where working across national boundaries is crucial to solving shared problems. But let's not write off patriotism just yet. Maybe we just haven't understood it properly. Martha Nussbaum, a leading contemporary American philosopher, tries to find room for national bonds and loyalties in what she calls a cosmopolitan worldview, one in which we see ourselves as citizens of the world and recognize our obligations to all people, not only to our neighbors and countrymen. Because Nussbaum's cosmopolitanism embraces the equal moral worth of all people in different clothing, she might offer us a way to be patriotic but not join the Dark Lord. To see how Nussbaum finds room for patriotism within a moral view that says all people are of equal moral worth, let's think back to the Hogwarts houses again. Imagine that we think that all Hogwarts students are equally deserving of an education, and we need to figure out the most effective way to provide them with the best education we can. We want all of them to be properly housed and fed, to learn their subjects, and to grow into responsible, educated wizards. The education of each student is as important as that of every other student. Yet this very desire, rooted as it is in the equal moral worth of all students, might lead us to endorse sorting the students into houses. Small houses, with their more intimate common rooms and dormitories, may be the best way to keep an eye on everyone, administer Hogwarts, and foster the friendship and mutual support that are necessary for students to succeed at school. The competition for the House Cup will motivate students to do well in their classes. Because they will want their house to win, they will study hard so that they can answer their teacher's questions correctly and earn their house points toward the cup. In other words, we might reasonably think that, as in a family, fostering a sense of house loyalty, pride and patriotism will be the most effective way to meet our goal of providing a quality education for all students. The reason, in other words, that Hermione should give special preference to the other Gryffindors is not because Gryffindor students are somehow morally superior to the students of other houses. Of course they aren't. But rather because if every student gives this sort of preferential treatment to the members of his or her own house, then all students will succeed and receive the education they deserve. Nussbaum makes the point in terms of parents caring for their children. To give one's own sphere special care is justifiable in universalist terms, and I think this is its most compelling justification. To take one example, we do not really think our own children are morally more important than other people's children, even though almost all of us who have children would give our own children far more love and care than we give others. It is good for children, on the whole, that things work this way, and that is why our special care is good rather than selfish. So, we may endorse the special regard for our own countrymen that patriotism involves, but we are justified in doing so, according to Nussbaum, only to the extent that such an attitude serves the interests of all people and doesn't require that others suffer so that we may prosper. If Americans give special care and attention to other Americans, and Chinese give that same sort of care and attention to other Chinese, and similarly with all of the citizens of each country, then everyone will, at least in theory, be taken care of and prosper. Patriotism can thus be a virtue when it serves the interests of the citizens of all countries. It becomes a vice when it fosters and promotes injustice and inequality. Figuring out when this occurs can be difficult, as Ron's struggles with the point of the Triwizard Tournament demonstrate, but it seems that Nussbaum leaves us a good deal of room to be patriots while still respecting the rights of people in other countries. The importance of community. Being a loyal and patriotic member of a group doesn't necessarily mean that you regard the members of your group as morally superior to everyone else. That is the difference between the patriotism of a Gryffindor and the bigotry of a Slytherin. But what is the value of group membership itself? Is your well-being dependent on your being a member of a well-defined community with clear boundaries and an unsullied connection to its historical traditions? Or might life in a community whose rich cultural traditions are insulated from the rest of the world be stifling and an inauthentic response to our modern situation? It's pretty clear how the Death Eaters, with their mantra of preserving the purity of wizarding blood, would answer this question. To thrive, wizards must keep their kind free from any intrusion from the non-wizarding world. So afraid of the outside world are they that Voldemort kills the Hogwarts Muggle Studies teacher, whose crime, aside from liking muggles, was advocating cultural mixing and the dwindling of the purebloods. The Death Eaters clearly think that flourishing as a wizard, living the good wizard life, requires being a member of the wizarding community, a community they believe must be kept pure and undiluted. The idea that human flourishing requires membership in a community that is united by common traditions and cultural practices, an idea taken to violent extremes by the Death Eaters, is known in political philosophy as communitarianism. Communitarians believe that participation in the life of some particular community provides meaning for our lives and is the source of our value systems. Indeed, drawing on Aristotle's claim that human beings are political animals and so can't achieve their full humanity outside of a polis, roughly a small political community, some communitarians assert that our very identities are tied to the community we are a part of. To understand how our identities are constructed by our membership in communities, think of Harry's identity as the boy who lived. This is central to how Harry sees himself, how everyone else sees him, and what he takes as his obligations and values. Nearly everything about Harry is centered on this role he has played in the wizarding world. Removed from that world, with its history, alliances, family relations and traditions, Harry wouldn't know who he is or what he should do. Indeed, we get a sense of how Harry is without the wizarding community when we see his life lived under the stairs before he enrolls at Hogwarts. His misery could be ascribed to his removal from his home community. Strong versions of communitarianism see community membership as a basic human need, like the need for food and shelter, which can seem reasonable once we recognize the importance of having a sense of who we are, a set of values, a meaning, and a life purpose. The crucial point is that according to communitarians, we get these only from belonging to groups united by common traditions, memories, cultural practices, and so on. If such communities are so essential to our well-being, there's good reason to think that we should work to preserve these communities and ensure that they do not disappear into the cultural melting pot. According to communitarians, our well-being is threatened when we are removed from these meaning-conferring communities, or when our community is threatened from outside by the forces of assimilation or modernity. But, of course, communitarians would have problems with the Death Eaters' tactics. Preserving strong cultural bonds is all well and good, but surely that doesn't require violence and acts of domination. Surely the mixed-blood wizards and other magical creatures need not be persecuted, and muggles need not be killed, in order for the wizarding community to preserve its identity. Matters get a little trickier when preserving cultural traditions involves violations of the liberty of members of that culture. Recent debates about the treatment of women in certain cultures, from female genital mutilation in certain traditional African cultures to the social oppression of women in certain Islamic cultures, just to name two, turn on the question of whether preserving cultural traditions or safeguarding individual liberty is more important. If we can't figure out how to preserve our culture without oppressing others, we may have a good reason to rethink communitarianism. Human flourishing and the preservation of dying cultures. Let's say we figure out a way to draw this line and decide to preserve certain cultures that are under threat of dying out or being assimilated. Is that a good thing? Is it worth our time and effort to do so? Does something bad take place when a minority culture, such as the Amish or Native American tribes, get swamped by the relentless tide of modernity? Would it be bad if all the centaurs left the Forbidden Forest and assimilated into the wizarding world, taking jobs at Hogwarts, as Fiorenzi did, in the Ministry of Magic or at Zonko's joke shop? Should special steps be taken to preserve dying or threatened cultures? Communitarianism provides one reason for doing so. The well-being of the people of that culture depends on its continued preservation. The implication is that if a culture dies out, its people will be cast adrift into the modern world and will suffer as a consequence of no longer belonging to their home culture with its history and ancestral traditions. Is that right? Do people really, as the contemporary philosopher Jeremy Walden puts it, need their rootedness in the particular culture in which they and their ancestors were reared, in the way they need food, clothing and shelter? So, which view of human well-being is correct? The communitarian view that people need rootedness in a traditional culture in order to live full human lives, or the cosmopolitan view that true human flourishing requires being a sort of cultural immigrant who moves among many cultures, mixing and integrating bits and pieces of different traditions? According to some philosophers, one powerful reason in favour of the cosmopolitan view of the good life is that it is the only reasonable response to life in the modern world. Perhaps centuries ago, when human communities were largely isolated from one another, the good life required continual membership in some traditional community. But in a modern, interconnected world, where people of different faiths, ethnicities, races and nationalities mix every day, whether online or on the streets of London, Mumbai or New York, human flourishing requires an ability to move comfortably among different traditions. As Waldron puts it, the hybrid lifestyle of the true cosmopolitan is the only appropriate response to the modern world in which we live. We live in a world formed by technology and trade, by economic, religious and political imperialism and their offspring, by mass migration and the dispersion of cultural influences. In this context, to immerse oneself in the traditional practices of, say, Aboriginal culture might be a fascinating anthropological experiment, but it involves an artificial dislocation from what actually is going on in the world. Earlier, we saw cosmopolitanism as a view about the equal moral worth of all persons. Here, cosmopolitanism is being offered as a view about what is necessary for human flourishing. It's more a view about the value of mixing and moving between cultures than it is about the moral worth of people. But the Harry Potter books make strong arguments in favour of both kinds of cosmopolitanism. In rejecting the racist view of Lord Voldemort, the books take a stand in favour of the equal moral worth of all persons. But when we think about how Harry was able to defeat Voldemort, we see that much of his success was due to his ability to move among cultures and his willingness to work together with people from different ethnic groups. Harry can move as easily in the Muggle world as he can in the Wizarding world. His best friends are the pure-blood wizard Ron, the Muggle-born wizard Hermione, and the half-human, half-giant, Rubus Hagrid. He talks to snakes, works with centaurs and goblins, and even befriends a house elf, a hippogriff, and a phoenix. Intercultural fluency is perhaps best demonstrated by the many characters who are part this and part that. In addition to Hagrid, there's the werewolf Remus Lupin, the animagus Sirius Black, the part Vila Fleur Delacour, and the half-human, half-horse Fiorenzi. If there's a moral lesson at the heart of the Harry Potter books, it is an endorsement of both sorts of cosmopolitanism. The idea that all people are of equal moral worth, and that flourishing in the modern world requires an embrace of other cultures and an ability to navigate among them. Chapter 8. Dumbledore's Politics. Beth Admiral and Regan Lance Reitzma. Political libertarianism teaches that the primary value that government should protect and respect is the personal liberty of each of its citizens. According to standard libertarian thinking, personal liberty is of such significant moral value that the only morally justifiable political state is highly restricted. Its only legitimate task is to protect its citizens from force, fraud, and theft. Is Albus Dumbledore a political libertarian? Even more, does the Harry Potter series support a libertarian political agenda? Several Potter commentators seem to think so. In Harry Potter and Imagination, Travis Prinzi argues that it is not difficult to see, in Dumbledore's behaviour and attitudes, a small government libertarian. And Prinzi describes the Potter series as a political fairy tale with an embedded political philosophy whose libertarian element is crucial to the plot and morality of Harry Potter. In the article Harry Potter and the Half-Crazed Bureaucracy, Benjamin Barton, a law professor at the University of Tennessee, argues that the Potter series contains an impregnable invective against government, an attack that he encourages the libertarian movement in America to take advantage of. Listen up, ardent lovers of liberty. Potter fans might wonder why Prinzi and Barton make these claims. The Potter series doesn't read like a libertarian manifesto. Wouldn't an extended argument for a libertarian political philosophy need to speak overtly and often, as many libertarians do, about the virtues of the free market and the vices of the modern liberal welfarist state, not to mention about the folly of engaging in entangling alliances with international organisations akin to the United Nations? But market deregulation, anti-welfarism, and a conspicuously robust conception of national sovereignty simply aren't major themes in the Potter books. Also, there isn't any direct evidence that Dumbledore favours a minimal night watchman state. Though he at various times holds several very influential positions within the wizarding world, headmaster of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, the supreme mugwump of the International Confederation of Wizards, and the chief warlock of the Wizengummet, at no point does he advocate any general political philosophy. Monarchist, communist, fascist, liberal democrat, libertarian, anarchist or other. And nowhere does Dumbledore spout any of the stock slogans commonly associated with libertarian theorising. He never pronounces, for instance, that the government that governs least governs best, or that each person has a natural right to full self-ownership. On what grounds, then, do Prinzi and Barton base their libertarian interpretations? Is Dumbledore a libertarian? Prinzi gives three basic arguments for the thesis that Dumbledore is libertarian-minded. First, Dumbledore is suspicious of political power. Second, he advocates personal freedom and political equality. Third, he has a hands-off management style that fits with a libertarian belief in a hands-off laissez-faire government. Let's consider these three arguments. First, Prinzi points out that Dumbledore clearly distrusts political power. How could he not, since he so often sees it misused? The Ministry of Magic, instead of being a help in time of need, is often an obstacle to defeating Voldemort. The Ministry was completely ineffective in preventing Voldemort's reign of terror during the Dark Lord's first rise to power. And as Voldemort's evil forces steadily and ominously gather again in Goblet of Fire, Percy Weasley and others at the Ministry are hard at work writing an officious policy about cauldron bottom thickness. All the while, Dumbledore must work behind the scenes to undermine the Dark Lord's plans. Also, the Ministry operates unjustly in suspending Dumbledore from his duties in Chamber of Secrets, in condemning Buckbeak in Prisoner of Azkaban, in charging Harry with underage use of magic in Order of the Phoenix, and in trying to impose Ministry control over Hogwarts that same year. Each time, Dumbledore must find a way to steer the course of events to a just conclusion. Dumbledore is, no doubt, smart enough to draw the conclusion that people in power often cannot be trusted. What's more, Dumbledore clearly understands firsthand how corrupting power can be. In Deathly Hallows, he admits that power was my weakness and my temptation, and says that he turned down the post of Minister of Magic several times because he had learned that I was not to be trusted with power. Do these considerations show that Dumbledore is libertarian-minded? No. This argument is a non sequitur. The conclusion simply doesn't follow from the supporting evidence, for libertarians do not have a monopoly on the idea that power corrupts. Political theorists of a variety of persuasions accept this claim. The US political system, which today is far from libertarian, attempts to limit the corrupting influence of power by implementing a system of checks and balances. No one branch of the federal government, the executive, the judicial, or the legislative, is allowed to have overriding power over the other two. The point is that there are mechanisms to limit the power of any one person or any one government agency, other than by implementing a libertarian political system. In fact, Lord Acton, who coined the famous saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, was a traditional Catholic who did not favour a minimal, non-moralistic state. Prinzi's second argument is that Dumbledore shares with the libertarian tradition a strong devotion to the value of personal liberty. No doubt he does. It is one of his most notable and praiseworthy traits. For instance, Dumbledore's treatment of the enslaved house elves who work at Hogwarts reflects such devotion. Dumbledore thinks the institution of house elf servitude should end. As Prinzi is right to emphasise, Dumbledore happens to favour, for strategic reasons, a gradual approach to changing the system. He chooses not to call for the immediate emancipation of house elves, because the elves, having been educated, or as Hermione says, brainwashed, to take pride in their identity as servants, would be deeply offended by the idea that they want to be free. Dumbledore understands this and offers the house elves the right to be paid for their work and to receive time off, but doesn't compel them to accept payment or vacation time. Dumbledore's policy allows the house elves to live with the idea of greater freedom and, when they are ready, to decide for themselves whether they would prefer to be free. This gradualism itself can be seen as a way of respecting the personal freedom of the house elves, though it amounts to letting them, for the time being, choose to be less free. Like libertarians, Dumbledore is tolerant of unpopular minority groups, and he often speaks up for victims of discrimination. For example, he works to save the lives of the last giants of Britain. The giants, given their brutish natures, do present a serious threat to the safety of both muggles and wizards, and so Dumbledore takes it upon himself to learn what is necessary to interact with these slow-witted and impulsive creatures, find a place for them to live, and suppress a safety movement to have them killed. Dumbledore is also willing to hire teachers at Hogwarts who belong to despised minorities, such as the half-giant, Rubius Hagrid, the werewolf, Remus Lupin, and the centaur, Fiorenzi. Finally, Dumbledore consistently opposes pure-bloodism and wizarding claims of superiority, saying that it matters not what someone is born, but what they grow to be. Dumbledore has, Prinzi concludes, a libertarian attitude toward personal freedom and the equality of each member of the wizarding world. Dumbledore clearly does place a high value on protecting the individual autonomy of each person. But again, libertarians aren't the only political theorists who sing the praises of liberty. Many political theorists, liberals for instance, would endorse the emancipation of house elves and equal rights for minority groups. If Prinzi wants to convince us that Dumbledore has the heart and the mind of a libertarian, he should provide evidence that Dumbledore's personal outlook has content that is distinctly libertarian. What sets political libertarianism apart from other strands within the liberal tradition is its commitment to the primacy of personal liberty. A libertarian not only believes in a moral right to personal liberty, but construes this right in a strikingly robust way. Let's consider three notable ways that libertarians restrict government interference with personal liberty, then ask whether Dumbledore advocates similar restrictions. Prinzi seems to think he does. First, libertarians oppose laws that restrict people's liberty for their own good. Liberal regimes often require the use of seatbelts or motorcycle helmets, prohibit steroid use by athletes, forbid people from swimming at certain beaches without a lifeguard, and extract money for retirement savings. They justify these practices, at least in part, on the grounds that these rules prevent people from harming themselves. But a properly respectful government, libertarians believe, will not be paternalistic. It will let its citizens make their own decisions, even if those choices will predictably have negative consequences. Second, libertarians oppose laws that outlaw victimless crimes or harmless immoralities, such as prostitution, gay sex, recreational drug use, and gambling. They believe that a government should not limit freedom simply because an act is considered immoral. A state is under a positive obligation to protect the liberty and the property of its citizens. But as John Locke might have put it, a civil magistrate should not concern himself with the care of souls. Third, libertarians are deeply critical of bureaucratic attempts to help the disadvantaged or to redistribute wealth in order to reduce economic inequality. When a state takes money from the haves and gives it to the have-nots, libertarians see this as state-sanctioned theft or forced labour. Many libertarians would agree that a private act of charity, a personal donation to Oxfam, say, is morally praiseworthy. But if a government forcibly takes your hard-earned money and gives it out as welfare, that's simply robbery by another name. At its heart, political libertarianism has a muscular conception of the moral life. It thinks in radically individualistic terms, strongly admires personal intelligence, creativity, strength, and initiative, views freedom as the master political value, is strongly skeptical of government power and bureaucratic solutions, and places considerable faith in the invisible hand of the market to create wealth and prosperity. With this brief sketch of libertarianism in hand, let's return to our discussion of Dumbledore's political views. Prinzi's third argument, his appeal to Dumbledore's hands-off management style, could be construed as his strongest attempt to reveal that Dumbledore not only shares several values in common with libertarianism, but has a notably libertarian mindset. Dumbledore has, as Prinzi put it, a willingness to let the people under his charge live and be free. Libertarians, as we've seen, believe that the state should not legislate paternalistic rules. Rather, it should permit its citizens to make their own decisions, however unwise. Dumbledore, Prinzi claims, also takes this view. As headmaster, Dumbledore largely permits faculty and students to do as they please, despite the many poor decisions they often and predictably make. Dumbledore presumably doesn't endorse Professor Binns's deadly dull lecturing, Hagrid's use of dangerous magical creatures, or Professor Sybil Trelawney's wacky teaching methods, nor, even more significantly, Does Dumbledore intervene to protect students against humanitarian, bias and cruelty? For instance, he permits Severus Snape to hang Neville Longbottom upside down in front of class, to take significant points from Gryffindor unjustly, and to withhold medical treatment from Hermione Granger when one of Draco Malfoy's spells inadvertently makes her teeth grow humiliatingly long. Dumbledore can't be accused, to say the least, of being a meddling headmaster. Even more conspicuous than the many unfortunate things that happen at Hogwarts under Dumbledore's watch is his approach to Harry. It seems to us, as we read through the series, that one of Dumbledore's most striking features is his absence. Dumbledore doesn't raise and educate orphaned Harry. He hardly contacts a lonely Harry during his painful summers with the Dursleys. He doesn't stand by 11-year-old Harry's side as the boy confronts Voldemort for the first time, or, for that matter, the second and third times in the Chamber of Secrets and in the graveyard at Little Hangleton. Dumbledore does give Harry, true enough, the tools necessary to fight Voldemort, but these tools do not guarantee young Harry's victory. They leave so much for Harry himself to do. Why isn't Dumbledore there, right beside Harry? Even when Dumbledore is physically present, Harry often finds Dumbledore terse and emotionally distant. What does all of this say about Dumbledore? Harry isn't the only one who finds Dumbledore inexplicably distant and disengaged. Amicus Carrow, the Death Eater, mocks Dumbledore.
"Always the same, weren't you, Dumby? Talking and doing nothing. Nothing!"
Red Hen, a popular Potter commentator, calls Dumbledore one of the very biggest non-chocolate frogs in the wizarding world, who has squandered the chance to reform wizarding society for decades. Prinzi has a more charitable interpretation. He thinks Dumbledore makes a principled choice not to micromanage other people's lives or to constantly apparate in to save the day. It isn't that Dumbledore is lazy, weak, or indifferent. Instead, Dumbledore believes that a leader is under significant restrictions against the use of coercive power, and he is willing to work within these self-imposed moral constraints. Dumbledore has, Prinzi thinks, a very robust conception of personal autonomy, one that implies that leaders ought to refrain from interfering with the choices other people make. Prinzi is even willing to claim that the motive that leads Dumbledore to stand by as Hogwarts teachers mistreat students is deeply libertarian. Dumbledore has, Prinzi thinks, the libertarian's muscular view of human life. He admires self-reliance and views life as a testing ground that gives people the opportunity to learn the life skills and develop the personal resolve necessary to make it in a tough world. As Dumbledore says to Severus Snape, "It has been essential to let Harry try his strength." Prinzi's argument that Dumbledore's management style reflects a libertarian mindset is unconvincing, though. For one thing, as libertarians would point out, managing a school is very different from running a government. Although libertarians oppose the government's use of coercion, they often find coercion appropriate within the family and within private institutions like Hogwarts. And the idea that personal freedom should be the master value, whether or not it makes sense in politics, makes no sense in running a school for teens and preteens. Libertarian ideals are grounded in the idea that adults should be permitted to govern their own lives because they have the ability to deliberate and make their own choices. But this reasoning can't sensibly be applied to 11-year-old children whose intellectual powers are still developing. For the sake of argument, though, let's permit the analogy between Hogwarts and a political society, and let's take Dumbledore to be the head bureaucrat of this society of teachers and students. Even if we grant this assumption, Prinzi's argument doesn't succeed, for libertarian thinking wouldn't lead a person to do what Dumbledore did, namely, stand by as students are bullied, mistreated, and endangered by faculty. Libertarianism is not anarchism. According to libertarian thinking, a person in a position of political power is under a moral obligation to intervene to protect those under his supervision from abuse. This is the central purpose of a political state. A clear-thinking libertarian bureaucrat would have intervened to prevent teachers from endangering students or treating them cruelly or unfairly. Also, a good libertarian leader would have required professors to live up to their contractual obligations to educate students. Dumbledore's failure to address the abusive behaviour and the lousy pedagogy of bad teachers doesn't reflect standard libertarian thinking. Prinzi claims that Dumbledore permits faculty to mistreat pupils because doing so will foster self-reliance in students and so strengthen their moral fibre. But this reasoning is deeply inconsistent with libertarian thinking. Libertarians believe that the political state should not take it upon itself to make its citizens into better people. The state is not charged with making its citizens decent, responsible, tough, courageous, or anything else, only safe. The reason that libertarians praise the virtue of self-reliance is not because they want bureaucrats to teach it, but because they recognize that in a society in which people do not receive significant protection from a well-intentioned, paternalistic state, this virtue is crucial. It's clear that Dumbledore does think he has the obligation, or at least the prerogative, to inculcate moral virtues in his students. But then it's important to notice that his management style does not reflect beliefs about the proper structure of a government. It reflects his views about the proper behaviour of headmasters. Barton's libertarian interpretation of the Potter series. Prinzi's arguments do not stand up to analysis. So, what about Barton's libertarian interpretation? He argues that J.K. Rowling's strikingly negative portrait of the Ministry of Magic and its bureaucrats is evidence that the Potter series as a whole has an implicit libertarian political agenda. Is this true? As Barton persuasively argues, the Potter books offer a scathing portrait of the Ministry. It's difficult to imagine a more hard-hitting indictment than Barton's own point-by-point analysis. What would you think of a government that engaged in this list of tyrannical activities? Tortured children for lying, designed its prison specifically to suck all life and hope out of the inmates, placed citizens in that prison without a hearing, ordered the death penalty without a trial, allowed the powerful, rich or famous to control policy, selectively prosecuted crimes. The powerful go unpunished and the unpopular face trumped-up charges. Conducted criminal trials without defence counsel. Used truth serum to force confessions. Maintained constant surveillance over all citizens. Offered no elections and no democratic lawmaking process and controlled the press. When confronted with political leadership as brutal and oppressive as this, it's easy to find yourself wondering, exasperated, whether the proper cure isn't to strip government of its power. But if this is the cure Barton means to encourage, his argument is unsound. A justifiable sense of exasperation at the Ministry of Magic is not an invective against government itself. More to the point, there isn't any compelling reason to think that the Potter series succumbs to this exasperation. To start with, the Ministry of Magic is not altogether corrupt. It includes good people and good laws. Arthur Weasley, though hampered by a very sketchy grasp of how Muggle artifacts work, is hard-working and honest. Dumbledore himself, except for a brief hiatus, holds the position of the chief warlock of the Wizengummet, a bureaucratic position, and he is not a bungling incompetent. In Order of the Phoenix, the majority of the members of the Wizengummet, a judicial body, vote in Harry's favour when he is brought up on bogus charges. The Ministry of Magic, although it includes many Orwellian-sounding bureaus, has been largely effective in keeping the existence of wizards secret from Muggles for many centuries and in restraining wizards from using their magical powers to rule the world. The Ministry also supports and enforces many sensible rules. For instance, when Harry is charged with violating the rule against underage wizardry in the presence of a Muggle, the rule makes a sensible exception for cases of self-defence. Not to mention, it is the Ministry that has the wisdom to appoint Dumbledore to the post of headmaster of Hogwarts. No doubt, the Ministry of Magic is far too often bungling, incompetent, and even positively corrupt. Several top Ministry officials, including Minister of Magic Pius Thicknesse, become Voldemort's puppets by being placed under the Imperius Curse. Many high-ranking officials, such as Minister of Magic Cornelius Fudge and ex-head of magic law enforcement Barty Crouch Sr., are autocratic and power-hungry. Others, such as Dolores Umbridge and Albert Runcorn, are downright evil. And some are just doddery old fools, like the members of the Committee on the Disposal of Dangerous Creatures. In summary, the premise of Barton's argument is an exaggeration, but very close to the truth. The Ministry of Magic is a lousy bureaucracy. The most questionable aspect of Barton's argument, though, is not its premise, but its inference. Why conclude, from the fact that the Potter series presents a portrait of bad governance, that the series advocates a minimal Night Watchman libertarian government? Is it that Barton assumes that less of a bad thing is better, and so a smaller ministry would be better? If so, his reasoning should lead him to favour political anarchism, which calls for the total abolition of government. Even if we set this glib retort aside, why think that when it comes to government, smaller is necessarily better? If seven of the justices on the Supreme Court were corrupt and demonstrably biased in their judgments, the proper response would be to replace the judges, not to downsize to a two-justice court. In brief, the proper antidote to bad governance is better governance, and it would take an argument, a very complex argument, to show that a government with a libertarian structure is the proper cure for the types of corruption and inefficiency evident in the Ministry of Magic. Does the Potter series make or even gesture at this argument? We are willing to grant that a careful evaluation of the Ministry of Magic provides strong grounds for thinking that a good government would put in place stringent safeguards to protect citizens from torture, barbarous punishments, unfair trials, and bureaucrats wielding truth serum. But it is a further question, once these safeguards are in place, whether a good government would do no more than protect the liberty, the property, and the bodily integrity of its citizens. Where is the evidence that the Potter series accepts a right to liberty as robust as the libertarian theory does? Or that the series as a whole is anti-welfare, or anti-paternalism, or anti-United Nations, or as confident in the free market as standard libertarianism? Barton claims, rather exuberantly, that J.K. Rowling will do more for libertarianism than anyone since John Stuart Mill. Who knows? His prediction, though not particularly plausible, could turn out to be true. But if a considerable number of readers do happen to infer from the Potter series that libertarianism is the best political theory, they will be guilty of the same leap in logic as Barton. It's worth noting that if there is a libertarian agenda in the Potter series, it is not likely to be there because of the author's intent. Rowling began writing the Harry Potter series while she was on welfare and has expressed no regret for that. Indeed, in voicing her own political views, Rowling has not supported libertarian values. On the contrary, she supported Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in the 2008 US presidential election, donated £1 million to the British Labour Party, and has said that her real-life hero is Robert F. Kennedy, hardly a paragon of small government. The Potter books do raise important questions about what a good government and good political leadership would be like. No doubt, the Ministry fails to respect, among other things, freedom and equality, and it would be very interesting to ask, what's the best way to fix the Ministry of Magic? But libertarians will have to do more than point to the poor example set by the Ministry or to the good example set by humble Dumbledore to argue soundly for a libertarian philosophy. Chapter 9. Dumbledore, Plato, and the Lust for Power. David Leigh Williams and Alan J. Kellner. Those who are best suited to power are those who have never sought it. Albus Dumbledore. A city in which those who are going to rule are least eager to rule is necessarily best. Plato. Lord Acton, in an oft-repeated phrase, observed that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. This phrase neatly sums up what most would consider common wisdom, yet the world finds itself persistently burdened by the abuse of power. Rulers continually find new and creative ways to line their pockets, privilege their friends, and secure, and even bolster, their own authority. The list of offences would shock even many Death Eaters, or perhaps fill them with envy. In an age that prides itself on its progress in technology, and even in morals, why is it that we have progressed so little in protecting ourselves against the usurpations of our rulers? Perhaps it is because we have not learned the important lessons of the first Western political philosopher, Plato, circa 428 to 348 BCE. Plato's solution to this problem is ingeniously simple. Power should never reside in the hands of those who lust for it. Rather, it should be granted only to those who would prefer to occupy themselves with other matters. It is disinterest in power that paradoxically makes the best rulers. This lesson turns out to be central to the climax of the entire Harry Potter series. Plato and Dumbledore, separated at birth. Albus Dumbledore lived in a stormy age. He saw the rise and fall of the dark wizard, Gellert Grindelwald, as well as Voldemort's reign of terror. He saw warfare, both with his wand and in the subtle forms of alliance building and intelligence gathering. He also had personal relationships with the most important players in the saga. Grindelwald was a close boyhood friend, and Voldemort was one of the most talented students at Hogwarts. These experiences taught Dumbledore about the precariousness of peace and the need for truly just rulers. Plato likewise grew up in an age of remarkable political upheaval. His entire youth was consumed by the decades-long Peloponnesian War between his home city of Athens and the mighty city-state of Sparta. The war and its aftermath provided opportunities to observe both the best and the worst in human nature. Like Dumbledore, Plato witnessed a power-hungry, talented fellow pupil, the tempestuous Alcibiades, rise to high military and political positions, only to betray Athens by siding with her Spartan enemies. Athens would go on to lose the war and suffer the indignity of having an imposed tyranny known as the 30, headed by the dreaded Critias. Critias was a bloodthirsty tyrant who just happened to be Plato's mother's cousin. Several years later, Plato is invited to travel to Syracuse in order to train the petulant son of the tyrant, Dionysius I. Indeed, Plato, like Dumbledore, had once seriously contemplated a career in politics. A natural choice, given his talents, family connections, and personal experiences. So, although Plato is sometimes regarded as a pie-in-the-sky philosopher, nothing could be further from the truth. His observations about politicians and their relationship with power are based on real-world experiences. What did Plato learn from his encounters with political power? His most detailed reactions to his own personal experiences are recorded in his seventh letter, addressed to the rulers of Syracuse. The letter recounts his own flirtations with political power, including the opportunity to join the 30 at the end of the Peloponnesian War. At first, he was deeply tempted to join with them in forging a new society, perhaps to promote the greater good, as the young Dumbledore and Grindelwald had desired. But he soon found that he could play no role in this new regime, which made the former government seem, in comparison, something precious like gold. The limitless power of the tyrants went to their heads and manifested itself in revenge killings, the settling of old scores, the confiscation of wealth, and ultimately, under the restored democracy, the unjust execution of Plato's beloved teacher, Socrates. This was enough to make Plato withdraw in disgust from a life in politics and ultimately dedicate himself full-time to philosophy. Just as the duel with Grindelwald that resulted in the death of Dumbledore's sister changed Dumbledore's mind about a political life. Like Dumbledore, Plato turned from politics to education. Dissatisfaction with politics led him instead to establish the Academy, the first university in Western civilization. The Academy is the root of our present English word, academic, and it was here that Plato experienced some of his greatest personal triumphs. The Academy's notable alumni included Cicero and Plato's own pupil, Aristotle. Plato would also write many of his most famous works while teaching there, on a wide range of subjects, including art, ethics, science, mathematics, philosophy, and even love. So, both Dumbledore and Plato found solace from the burdens and temptations of politics in teaching the young. Plato's retreat from political life, however, was hardly a retreat from systematic thought about politics. In much the same way that Dumbledore remained integral to magical politics, even as a professor at Hogwarts. Plato found the Academy the perfect place to reflect on the political world and to distill the wisdom he had acquired in experience, His political philosophy is most fully and artfully rendered in his work, The Republic. Perhaps the most memorable proposal in this work is the office of the philosopher-ruler. The ideal society Plato sketches in The Republic consists of three classes: a working class, soldiers, and rulers. It is this last class that possesses all policy-making powers, as well as the day-to-day oversight of state affairs. Plato's philosopher-rulers hold enormous power, and it is crucial that they be the best and most qualified persons to rule. In particular, they must possess each of the four cardinal virtues: justice, courage, wisdom, and self-control. To ensure that only the wisest and most virtuous citizens become rulers, Plato proposes a rigorous and lengthy educational process designed to sort out the wheat from the chaff. This process puts even Hogwarts to shame, lasting until age 35, followed by a 15-year internship in public service. By the end, Plato hoped, we should be able to distinguish the Potters from the Malfoys. To be sure, paramount for Plato among the qualifications to rule is intelligence. He makes it repeatedly clear that rulers must be quick learners and possess an unusually good memory. It is often rightly said that Plato was the first philosopher to advocate openly the joining of political power with intellectual heft. Indeed, this is why he insists that the only qualified rulers are philosopher rulers, those who exceed all others in their cerebral powers. Although this is perhaps the most celebrated element of Plato's qualifications to rule, intelligence alone is not enough. From popular culture, we all know many brilliant criminals who employed their gifts for devious purposes. Lex Luthor from Superman, Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs, Anakin Skywalker from Star Wars, and even Dr. Evil from Austin Powers. Mere intelligence may be an essential prerequisite for ruling, but Plato's demands transcend a supersized cranium. Rulers must combine their brains with virtue. The question, in Plato and in Potter, is how to distinguish between the gifted who will use their power for good and those who will use it for selfish ends. Most notably, those burdened by excessive self-love are unfit for ruling. They are often among the most intellectually gifted of the students, but have difficulties in resisting their impulses, and those who would flatter them. Like Voldemort, they view political power as a means to feed one's desires. Thus, they lust after power. They crave it and climb all over themselves to secure it. But it is precisely this lust for power that suggests their unsuitability for wielding it, according to Plato. When ruling is something fought over, civil and domestic war destroys these men, and the rest of the city as well. Tyrants like Critias usually live short lives and are capable of bringing the entire state down with them. Recall, for example, that Voldemort's life, in any corporeal or physical sense, is relatively short as well. In Sorcerer's Stone, he must drink unicorn blood to regain his strength. He must feed off the life of another until he can assume a physical form again. Even though Plato was assuming that magic could not be used to save oneself, his analysis of tyrants also holds true in Harry's world. We should therefore rather seek out rulers who are disinterested in holding political power. A city in which those who are going to rule are least eager to rule is necessarily the best. Plato offered a useful test for readers to distinguish those who might succumb to the temptations of power from those who would resist, a tale known as The Ring of Gyges, a legend that J.K. Rowling resuscitates and mirrors in the tale of the Deathly Hallows with Harry's invisibility cloak. More on this shortly. Plato's tale is delivered by the character Glaucon, who was Plato's brother in real life. According to the story, a shepherd finds a magical ring uncovered by an earthquake and discovers that by turning the ring toward himself, he becomes invisible. Possessed of this new talent, the formerly modest shepherd immediately sets out to seduce the king's wife, attack the king with her help, and kill him, and seize the king's power for himself, all in rapid succession. Glaucon argues that no one would be so incorruptible that he would stay on the path of justice or bring himself to keep away from other people's possessions and not touch them, when he could take whatever he wanted from the marketplace with impunity, go into people's houses and have sex with anyone he wished, kill or release from prison anyone he wished, and do all the other things that would make him like a god among humans. Plato's implicit reply is that Glaucon's conclusions apply only to those who lust after power. The truly just and good, those fit for political power, would conduct themselves in precisely the same way, whether they were invisible or not. For those few qualified individuals, there is no ambition to promote one's selfish interests over that of friends and fellow citizens. So, there is no political benefit to invisibility. In the end, then, Plato wants political power to reside in the hands of the wise and virtuous. These qualities are best manifested in the indifference of rare individuals to the temptations of power. The Ring of Gyges is among the best tests to sort out those who can be trusted with this type of power. Indeed, this question of who can resist the great temptations of power is one of the central questions, if not the most important, to be investigated in the Harry Potter series. Fudge and Umbridge, the lessons of obviously unfit power brokers. If Plato faced great challenges in securing incorruptible political power in his ideal republic, the challenges facing governance in the more practical, though magical, world of Harry Potter must be nearly insurmountable. With Dolores Umbridge's acts of umbrage in her year of tyrannical rule at Hogwarts, Cornelius Fudge's refusal to believe clear evidence of Voldemort's return, and Rufus Scrimgeour's tactless blandishments to Harry in exchange for his service, there is good reason to question whether proper rule in the wizarding community is even possible. Is the ministry destined to be corrupt? Rowling's characters have much to teach about the nature of political power as we examine a few possible candidates for Minister of Magic: Umbridge, Fudge, Voldemort, Dumbledore, and Harry. No fan of the Potter series would consider Dolores Umbridge a model citizen, let alone a just ruler. In fact, Umbridge's relentless onslaught of rules, vicious detention measures, and Gestapo-like tactics for gaining and maintaining control might make us wonder why she was not in Voldemort's cohort, rather than the Ministry's. Nevertheless, she holds positions of power in the series, both at the Ministry and at Hogwarts. A platonic evaluation of her time as a leader must be negative. She provides an object lesson in how not to rule. Readers can understand Umbridge's unsuitability for rule from two simple facts. First, that she lacks all the necessary virtues Plato discusses in the Republic: courage, wisdom, justice, and self-control. Umbridge's lack of self-restraint is a particular weak spot. All it takes is one snide remark, and her passive-aggressive rage is unleashed, hardly something Plato would expect of a successful philosopher-ruler. Second, and more important, all of Umbridge's torment tactics reveal her inner lust for power. Take, for instance, Harry's detentions with Umbridge in Order of the Phoenix. She instructs him, "I want you to write, I must not tell lies, as long as it takes for the message to sink in." This sink in, as we all know, is quite literal, and her cruelty seems only to increase relative to the amount of power she is given. As the year progresses, and she attains a more prominent role of authority at Hogwarts by the Ministry, her decrees multiply, as do her detentions. We might even speculate that her incremental increases in authority merely fuel her lust for more power. One thing is certain, though. Plato would have expelled her from his academy. Whereas Umbridge never rose to the position of Minister of Magic, the almost equally dangerous and inept Cornelius Fudge did. Part of what made him such a poor minister was his perpetual fear of losing power. This concern fostered dictatorial tendencies that manifested in a control of the press. The Dark Lord's return to power was partly due to Fudge's failings as a leader. For example, when Harry announced that Voldemort had in fact returned, Fudge resorted to trashing Harry in the press in order to maintain his own public image, an image that only got worse once the truth came out. Umbridge's position as the Hogwarts High Inquisitor is another example of Fudge's attempts to maintain power in unjust ways. Recall how at the beginning of Order of the Phoenix, Harry is brought to court for producing a Patronus to protect himself and his cousin Dudley from Dementors. The Dementors were not supposed to be away from Azkaban. To cover up the Ministry's mistake, Fudge brings Harry to trial and does all that he can to tilt the scales against him. He moves the time of the hearing, for instance, in an attempt to make Harry late and to prevent Dumbledore from attending. All of this goes to show that Fudge's virtues as a ruler are at best dubious. He craves power, but his insecurity leads him to use that power for his own advantage, rather than for the public good. He stumbles over himself in his attempts to maintain power, which prevents him in the end from keeping